girls still don't think I'm cool.
It's mostly men who will comment on anything shirtless related.
My parents control money with me. Like, you're in my house, I pay the bills, you're gonna do what I say. So it was like, all right, fuck you then. I'm gonna do what I want, and I gotta go acquire capital in order to do what I want. The people I admire are screw-ups and fearful, just like I am. And it felt like I used to have bad eyesight, and once I met these people and got to intimately know them, I put good eyeglasses on it. And like, I was like, the world is clear. I can dominate this just like these guys do, because it's okay that I'm a screwed-up person.
So what's been going on? What have you been doing today?
I had to record MFM, and then I had to do this last thing. Now I'm doing your thing. I'm in Westport, Connecticut, living in a 7,500 square foot house, testing out what it's like.
Nice drop of the 7,500 square foot. Very good.
It's a rental, and I got a steal, but I just wanted to see what it would be like to rent a big house, and I lose everything, and so I've learned I don't want a big home.
So do you want to just give a little bit of background on yourself? I'm assuming most people know who you are. I'm assuming anyone who knows me probably knows you from MFM or whatever. But can you just talk a little bit about, like, you know, you built The Hustle, you sold it, you started MFM. It's been insanely successful. What are you doing now, and how are you thinking about work going forward?
My 60-second background is that I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I grew up with my mom being a teacher. My father owned a produce business selling fruits and vegetables, basically. I went to college in Nashville, Tennessee. I started my first business, which was a hot dog stand. I realized the internet was awesome, and I heard about a company called Air Bed and Breakfast at the time. That's what it was called. I cold emailed the founder, Joe Gebbia, who you met recently, and I was like, interview me for a job, and here's why you should. And he was like, do you live in the Bay Area? I said, yes, which I didn't. He's like, all right, great, come to my office Monday. So I fly out there, go to his office Monday, get a job offer. I leave school and move out there. I lied on my resume because I actually had a DWI, and I lied about it, and they did a background check, and they caught me. So the day before I was supposed to show up, they said, you're fired because you're a liar. And that was right on their part. I did lie. And then I started, so I was in San Francisco with nothing. So I started a roommate matching business, which was like Tinder for roommates, which is stupid. It should have just been Tinder for Tinder. Sold that, only made like 50 grand or something. Started a conference called HustleCon. That made like 60 grand in the first 6 weeks, and then like 200 or 150,000, I forget, $1,000 in profit in the first like 10 months when I hosted it again. After that, I parlayed that success into The Hustle, which was a newsletter, which everyone at the time laughed at newsletters. Now everyone thinks they're awesome, and I think they are awesome. I sold that business for tens of millions of dollars. Towards the end of that company, The Hustle, Sean Puri, who was my friend, was like, I want to create this podcast called My First Million. I've recorded the first episode. Here it is. I said, that's awesome. The Hustle will become your publisher. We publish it after about 8 or 10 episodes. He was like, just come on and do the thing that we do. So I did. And that's kind of how the podcast became what it is today. And then most recently, I started a company called Hampton, which is, if you've heard of YPO or Chief or some of these other companies, it's a community-based business. So it's founders of companies typically in the $25 million revenue range. They pay to be a member. We interview them. We vet them. And then I think that's going to be a pretty huge company. And I'm focused mostly on that. So I split time between MFM and Hampton.
So when you think about, like, what drives you in this next phase, so you did really well. I think you made enough money that if you wanted, you could retire. Now, how do you think about work?
I made enough money that I didn't have to work again, but I didn't make enough money to please my ego. That's for sure. Is your book out by the time this podcast is live?
No, but we can talk about it a little bit.
Well, I don't want to give it away, but you and I have similar anxiety around money, which is, for some reason, it never feels like enough, whether that is because we have fears of running out or fears that we're inadequate compared to our peers. I still very much have that. And so I'm working somehow to please that. But I would say I'm also doing it a bit as like an artist, where I feel like I'm compelled and obsessed about creating things, and no different than an artist, whether they're good or bad. I'm not saying I'm a great artist, but, you know, I'm just like addicted to launching stuff and the dopamine that comes with creating things.
So in this next business, you've delegated a lot. So I think your old business, you were like command and control. The Hustle was you. You know,
I was the dictator. Team,
but you're the dictator. And in this business, you've hired a CEO, and now you're delegating the operations to them. What's that been like for you?
Heavily inspired by you. And it's been awesome. So there's been like headaches where I'm still trying to, and I'm text you all the time where I complain about how do I deal with this situation? Am I getting in the weeds too much? Am I not in the weeds too much? And so there's been like those normal pains of learning a new skill set and having a new structure, but it's been awesome. So basically I'm like the marketing department because I've got the podcast and I've got my personality, whatever you want to call my brand. And that drives growth. I also am quite good at coming up with interesting ideas that pounce on opportunities. So that's what I focus on. But I've hired a CEO who runs the company on a day-to-day basis. Eventually, I'll launch more companies and have more CEOs, I think. But it's been life-changing. I wish I would have done it sooner. I didn't have the confidence to do it. And I also was too much of a puss to break the mold. And hanging out with you rubbed off on me. And I realized there's many ways to build great companies. And I like your way.
Well, that's awesome. And I would say my way, like anything else, the grass is always greener, as you'll learn that there's lots of downside to doing it this way. But in terms of like abstracting away work, it's definitely very elegant.
And it's not like I work less, by the way. And we'll talk about the daily routine, which is something on here. I still am doing, you know, I say a 40-hour work week. Some weeks it's 30, some weeks it's 90 hours. You know, it varies, but I still have like a 9-to-5 job. I'm just not in charge of HR like I used to be. Or I don't like look at the budget all the time. I don't make the budget. Do you know what I mean? And I only focus on things that I actually add a significant amount of value towards.
Yeah, Chris has a saying, there's no such thing as problems, there's only people problems. So if you can have someone else deal with the people problems, that's a pretty good life.
Yeah, and I have a people problem as well, right? I've got to make sure the CEO is happy and he feels rewarded and all those things. But I work with him. I don't work with the other 20 people or the 50 contractors we have.
So you mentioned that, you know, we're both afflicted by this feeling of never enough, you know, which obviously I relate to. And, you know, I wrote a book about it. And that's kind of also what I want this podcast to be a little bit about, probing a little deeper with people about, you know, pulling back the curtain and seeing like, well, what makes this person tick and why are they still going and what drives them? And I wanted to ask you, I was talking to my therapist and I was talking about this feeling that I have where, you know, whenever I get white space, I fill it. If I have excess time, I will, you know, I'll buy 20 books when I have time to read two. I'll start right. 10 companies when I have time to run one. Like I'm always stacking up. And she just stops me and she goes, Andrew, what would you have to feel if it wasn't for all this? And it kind of stopped me in my tracks. I was like, well, geez, I don't know. Like, I've always looked at it as this very positive thing, right? Because it really serves you in business to be generative and start new stuff all the time. But I did have to ask myself, am I distracting myself from something? Right? What is it that actually is driving me? Do you have a sense of that? Like what would happen if you just like stopped for a year or 2 years?
So I think that when a lot of people like us complain, there's like, oh, and people are like, you shouldn't keep doing shit. And then, but sometimes the answer is like, dude, I love this. I like it. Like, shut up. Don't try to change me. Like, I'm actually happy. I'm not unhappy. I'm happy. I have traumatic things that I'm always working through, but I'm happy.
When I thought about it after my therapist asked me, I went, you know what? It's interesting. When I was in school, I was always like popular, like I was likable and whatever, but I was never the guy, right? I wasn't like the guy that everyone wanted to hang out with. It would be like, I would be friends with like a bunch of different groups or whatever. And so one of the things I realized about myself is that when I started my companies, I was the guy, right? Suddenly it's like my own little clubhouse that I've started where I'm important and I'm the dictator and I get to figure out how everything goes. So there's, you know, maybe like a little bit of stuff there. And then the other piece is like when I grew up, I just didn't want my parents to tell me what to do. My parents were controlling and I just wanted to rebel against that. And so that manifested in me going and starting all these businesses. Do you have something similar? Like why are you the way you are?
So we'll start, let's go through Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So like on the bottom is like stuff you want. I don't really want stuff except for I want a big house where my family could come and they don't annoy me because they have their own space. That's basically the only stuff I want. And I have that now. I don't really need any cars. I don't need to fly private. Maybe I'll do those things, but I don't need any of that crap. But so I wanted to start businesses to acquire some things like that. The next thing is I wanted to acquire was I wanted to be like a time billionaire. I wanted to spend my time how I want. I realized at a young age, life's short. So if I work really hard for a short amount of time, we live in a capitalistic society that's never going away. So the best way to win is to have enough money that you could tell anyone to go fuck themselves and I could spend my time how I want. And then if we go up that need or that hierarchy a little bit, then there's like, I start stuff because my parents controlled money with me. Like, you know, it was like, not that they were like crazy about it, but it was like, you're in my house. I pay the bills. You're going to do what I say. So it was like, all right, fuck you then. I'm going to do what I want. And I got to go acquire capital in order to do what I want. And then if we go higher up that list, it's basically a deep seated like insecurity of like, girls didn't want to date me. I felt bullied. I had braces. I was goofy looking, even though I was probably actually the bully. But I like felt insecure. And then I grow up and I see people like you. You're only a few years older than me. You were fortunate that you found your path, whether you found it on purpose or you fell into it. You found this really cool path and you carved out that path at an early age. I carved out a different path and I'm like, shit, Andrew found this other path that I like more. Now I have to feel like I'm behind him now. I got to hurry up and catch up. And I want to be, not that I want you or what you represent or my friends who are like this as well. I don't want to crush your tower. It's like, I want to have a skyscraper just as big because I want to feel adequate and I want to feel as good. Like I belong to have, I should have a seat at the table. So it's basically comes down to like a feeling of inadequacy.
One of the things I've observed about the most successful people I meet is when they see someone that they're jealous of. So it's like, oh, they have a thing I want. They just go, okay, well, I'm as smart as them. What are the cheat codes? How do I work backwards from whatever they did? And I'll just copy that and learn. And it's not about tearing the other person down. Like you said, it's really, you put it really well. You said, I just want to build a skyscraper next to yours.
Yeah. I don't want you to, like, you know, the cool thing about capitalism is it's a lot of people think that it's a winner takes all market. It ain't. I can create value and you can create value. And so I just want to be a serious person and to prove that I've got the chops to do what I think I'm capable of doing. I used to host these events called HustleCon. So we probably had 200 or 150 speakers at them. And so we've had Grammarly, people like you. I don't know if you ever spoke at one, but people like you, Casper, Away Travel, WeWork, just whatever. Any startup that you could think of that was started around the 14 to 18 era, they probably spoke at our events. And I would be backstage with these guys. And I would meet them like Alex from The Athletic, which is like a big media company that sold for hundreds of millions of dollars, or whoever. Sam Yagan from OkCupid and Match.com. And I would meet these people, and for the most part, I would hang out with them and I would think, I don't think you're significantly smarter than me. And in some cases, I think you're actually dumber than me, but we're mostly all in the same ballpark. There was only like three or four people, Max from Grammarly being one of them, where I'm like, yeah, dude, you have more horsepower than me. Like my oven doesn't burn that hot. You just actually are smarter than me. And there's nothing that I can do. It's genetics. But for the most part, I was like, we're in the same ballpark, but you're like way more successful than me in the terms of traditional success. That's bullshit. I should have that too. And what's interesting is that you have the same fears that I have. Like I would be backstage and I remember Sam Yagan, who has started OkCupid, and then he was the CEO of Match.com, I think it was, you know, multi-billion dollar company. He was so nervous to speak at this event. And I remember I had to calm him down, not calm him down, but I was like, hey, Sam, are you okay? Do you want to talk it through? I could tell you seem a little high strung. You know, I'll just be your sounding board for a minute. And I remember like these people were so nervous and they were bitching about they got to fire someone, but they're afraid of the confrontation, or they were like they had just raised $100 million in funding. And I'm like, dude, why are you freaking out? He's like, I don't know how we're going to spend this in order to live out this valuation. So they had all these normal fears that I have. And I remember it feeling like, this is awesome. The people I admire are screw ups and fearful, just like I am. And it felt like I used to have bad eyesight. And once I met these people and got to intimately know them, I put good eyeglasses on. And like, I was like, the world is clear. I can dominate this just like these guys do, because it's okay that I'm a screwed up person. And so that gave me so much confidence.
Yeah, this is the problem. I feel like, you know, on Instagram, people compare their looks to, you know, these beautiful people photoshopped or whatever. But then on podcasts, they compare themselves to us. And it's like, we don't go on MFM and talk about all the ways that we're fuck ups and all of our stresses. We go on there usually prepped and we've prepared. Well, for me, I've prepared for a day. I've got all these smart things.
Oh, we prepare.
You know, you guys prepare too. And it's like, we look really smart, but behind the scenes, everything tastes like chicken, man. Like I'm in not Hampton, but I have my own forum groups. I've got four of them. And so I've been doing that for about 15 years, and there's probably 24 men and women that I'm in these forum groups with. And I've seen like every single person that I look at and I go, that person's got it figured out. Within 2 or 3 years, I go, oh, okay, that's their thing that stresses them out. And every single person has something that's driving them insane. People
and it's
problems,
awesome.
Financial
it's awesome
stress.
To see that.
Totally. Cause it humanizes everybody. You realize everyone is doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's awesome. And if you read like, you know, there's so many people who are like, oh, Elon Musk, my hero, he's awesome. And then you read about divorce, like he doesn't look very healthy. Whatever this is like, all right, all of our shit stinks and we all have flaws. And I think that's very invigorating when I hear that. And I see that I'm a member of Hampton as well. And I've got guys who are worth many, many hundreds of millions of dollars and they're wonderful people, but they all got shit. You know, everyone sucks a little bit. And so it's totally awesome to see that.
You mentioned, you know, your parents being like, hey, you're in my house, you know, I've got control. What did it feel like for you to make more money than your parents? I don't know if you do now, but you do. And how did that change the dynamic? And then also, what do your parents think of you? Like, are they like proud? Are they supportive? Or are they kind of like, you know, prove yourself? Like, how's that played out for you? Because it seems like every entrepreneur has that chip on their shoulder.
It does. And I'll tell you, here's the experience. So the experience is you're on your computer on Christmas break, when you're at home, you're working on your computer. They say, why don't you get a real job? You're not working. And I'm like, you guys quit bothering me. I'm working. And they're like, dude, you're playing on your phone. I'm like, you don't get it. And then you do that for about 5 years. So I did that for 5 years. And then they start realizing, oh, you have health insurance. I don't know what your job is, but that's cute. That's cool. If it fails, maybe you'll get a real job, whatever. And then my exit happened. And I remember it said like Sampar sells Hustle for a rumored like $40 million or something in some article. And I shared them the headline and they're like, okay, but do you have health insurance? And and like, they like didn't quite understand. And then they start seeing some things in your lifestyle change. Or in my case, that changed a little bit, but it was like with the podcast, at least it was like people would start recognizing me on the street. Or people would start emailing my parents because they found their email somehow and they would ask them questions. And they're like, okay, this is weird. And then they see like maybe your lifestyle changes a little bit. And they're like, all right, this is cool. Congratulations. We're so proud of you. And then I think lately what it's turned into is intimidation, where it's like this weird thing of like they feel inadequate sometimes like being around me. And I'm like, you guys, that's just absolutely ridiculous. Like, that's not how I'm from Missouri. And so they're right now I'm in basically Greenwich, Connecticut, looking to maybe buy a house. And like they're like, maybe they don't feel worthy sometimes, or they feel intimidated or in a weird way. And I'm like, that's just absolute bullshit. You should never in a million years feel that way. And then occasionally things happen where family or distant family will ask for stuff. And more likely than not, you should always say no to that. And that causes some tension. And so there some weird rifts kind of do happen. But I think you have to let people know that like this money is just it's really not important. What's important is just that I've carved my own path. And it just so happens that the outcome is money. But it could be just as cool if it were art or a family or being a great teacher.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, be careful what you wish for. Like when I was growing up, money in my household was like super stressful. My dad's business was always struggling, or my parents never had enough money. And then as a kid, when I was in high school, I was the kid who would bum money off friends. Like I never had money for beer. I'd always be borrowing money from people. You know, I'd pay them back, but I was always broke. And so when I got money, I was like, oh, this is going to be awesome. I can like share it with everybody and like give my parents money, and I can like give my friends money and all this stuff. And I noticed it just created weird dynamics. Like
it creates a weird dynamic.
And also like, you know, brought siblings, you know, I worked with two of my siblings, that adds complexity. Like it's really, really, and don't get me wrong, there's people that pull this off, but usually when you peel back behind the scenes, it becomes like a business operation, not a family.
Well, ultimately, it doesn't matter. So it's not actually that important. And so like I admire a family member who's a good parent just as much as I admire a billionaire. I just admire people who are ambitious and get after it, whether that's being whatever they want to be or a business person. And it also doesn't matter because usually I found the way it works is you feel inadequate. And so you want to like tell your parents like, no, I'm legit. Like I can do it. You see, like here's all these articles about me. And then it's like, all right, I had an exit. I've got money. Let me treat everyone. Let me buy all this stuff. But then it goes to the next thing, which is like, dude, this is embarrassing. Like, I don't want anyone to feel uncomfortable. This is not. And plus, I don't even think that this is important. Like you shouldn't value a person just because of the money thing. So I'm actually just not even going to bring it up, and let's just hide anything.
And yeah. that's where we are now, which is like, I don't want to, if you ask me how much something costs before, I would brag about it. I would probably double the price just to look cooler. Now it's like, dude, I don't even want to tell you what I have because it's just A, not important. And B, I don't want you to feel like inadequate or anything like that.
So you got rich, but then interestingly, you also got famous 2 years later. And you know, you're not Leonardo DiCaprio famous.
Maybe popular is the right word. Yeah.
Well, okay. If we just look at business bros, you're famous amongst business bros, right? You get stopped on the street, all that experience. What's that been like for you?
First of all, I feel immense gratitude. So I don't know how many people listen to the podcast now, but many, many millions per month. Last year, we had 100 million like downloads and YouTube views, which is a lot. And when someone comes up to me, it's nothing like Mr. Beast, but it's like good for our little niche. And when someone comes up in the street, which happens, you know, a bunch of times a day, I feel so much gratitude. I'm like, I can't believe you listened to us. Like, that's just, I feel so thankful that you would give me your attention. But then on the other side is I feel incredibly uncomfortable. So I feel a little bit uncomfortable for safety reasons. I also feel more uncomfortable because I don't want them to think that I'm some guru who has the answer, because I don't. I'm just thinking out loud a lot of times when I'm talking. I also think that I feel a little bit a sense of inadequacy, because I'm like, just so you know, there's people that are way more successful than I am who just shut up and don't talk about it. And you're only glamorizing me because I've got a loud mouth. I'm not actually the baller. You know, the real ballers are the people I'm talking about. And so you should admire them. And so I feel a sense of like, dude, you don't want to talk to me. Talk to the people I'm talking about. Like, I'm just a talking head right now.
Do you ever worry that you're getting a false version of somebody when you meet them because they know who you are?
Yeah.
Like, do you ever think one of the things I noticed is like when I didn't have money and success, you know, I would meet, you know, I think back to high school and it'd be like the guy who's like, I don't know, just some guy who's kind of a dick would be kind of a dick to me. But now that same guy is like a successful, you know, investment banker and he wants to raise money for my company. And suddenly he's like my best buddy and treating me really well. Now I know because I went to high school with this person, I'm just making this up, but I know because I went to high school with this person, this guy's actually a dick or a weasel. But if I just met him without knowing him from high school, I'd be like, oh, this guy's really nice. Right? Do you worry about that at all?
Yeah. So I basically have a group of five friends who like, they have keys to my home. They are on my kids' like trusts or whatever. And like, I will give them my bank account and I will tell them every single thing about me and I won't hold back anything. And so that's my small crew and it's like my tribe. And then there's like 10 or 15 other people, of which I would put you in that category, where I also like won't hide anything. And I'm like, here's my net worth. Here's my portfolio. I don't care. You could see all of it. Here's a screenshot of the thing. I'm going through this issue. I'm arguing with my family about this. I'll share all types of stuff with you. And then outside of that circle, everyone else is a no. I don't want to share anything with you. And so it's important. You just have this tight tribe. And I think that you can bitch about anything. You can complain about anything. You could brag about anything, because that's important too. You're like, I'm so happy about X, Y, and Z. I'm scared about this thing, whatever. And then everyone else is no. We have a rule in the house that I say, which is no new friends. Like, we can't have new friends. And so I remember I got this friend now who is somewhat new, and I was rude to him for 6 months. He was trying to like be friends with me, and he sent me a gift when my dog died, and he like did all this stuff. And I realized, oh, you're actually a great guy. I want to be friends with you. And I remember texting him, and I go, I just want to let you know, I'm really sorry. I was rude to you on purpose. So I'm not exactly sorry for being rude to you, but I just felt like you wanted something from me. And I treat everyone this way, where I default, like he would say like, hey, do you want to come over? I'm like, nope, I don't want to come over. Or, hey, I've got this thing for you. I'll stop by. Cause I know Sarah said she wanted X, Y, and Z. I'm like, nope, please don't do that. And I'm purposely rude to those people. And that's kind of the downside a little bit. You can't really trust anyone outside of a certain circle.
That's so interesting. I remember detecting that with you even back in the day. One of the things I've really appreciated about you is you're very blunt, right? You'll just be like, no, I don't want to do that. Or you'll be a bit rude. And at first I was like, man, Sam's kind of a dick. And then I realized like, no, you're actually really sweet, but you're just very, very honest with that kind of stuff. And I it's interesting. I've been working on learning how to just say no to people. I would never, if someone invited me over, even if it's someone who I think is like a manipulative weasel trying to get something out of me, I would never just say nope. And I've been trying to get to that point where you just go, no, I don't want to do that. right? Is there anything I figured out, or is that just you?
I usually have I have like excuses. So I loved when I was getting married because we're doing wedding planning, and then COVID happened. So it was a COVID excuse. I told so many people I had COVID when I like never did. I only got it like once or twice. And it was like, I actually had it, but I lied so many times about that. And then it was pregnancy, you know, can't do that. We're pregnant. We got to do this other thing. Now we've got baby. So like I usually have excuses.
So, okay. So you mentioned before you were like, you're a funny looking kid growing up. You weren't cool. You didn't think girls paid attention to you and stuff. Over the last 2 years, 3 years, I feel like you've gone from like, you know, geek to freak. You got like really ripped and fitness has been a big priority and stuff. I'm curious, what's that experience been like? And then also, what else has changed over the last 5 years, other than having kids and getting married and stuff? Like, well, how you think about how you operate?
Girls still don't think I'm cool. Well, for the record, so it's mostly men who will comment on anything shirtless related. So it's girls still don't give a shit. Your wife doesn't care.
Yeah, this is not the audience. You do not have the right audience to meet girls.
Yeah, girls don't care about any of this. My audience is basically 50% white dudes, 50% Indian guys.
It's a little bit like, I remember when I bought a Porsche like years ago, I was trying to celebrate a big deal we had done. And I bought a Porsche and I was so excited. I was like, man, you know, girls, I'm going to get so much attention from girls. It was just middle-aged men. I'd be like coming out of Whole Foods carrying two heavy bags. And it's always a 65-year-old man who wants to talk to you about your car. It's exactly the same with MFM. It's just like a 23-year-old tech bro.
Yeah, girls are nicer to me when they see me walking with my daughter than any amount of car or anything fancier than that. They don't give a shit. So how has it changed? Yeah, so I got fit. So basically I had like a drug and drinking issue out of college, and I was a college athlete. So I used to kind of be like a freak in terms of like athleticism and being fit. I was a very good competitive athlete. And then I spent like 6 or 7 years and I got really fat and lumpy. And then I met my wife and she taught me a lot about nutrition. She was always like paying attention to like what she was eating and exercising. And so after I sold the company, I was like, screw this. I'm getting really into fitness. And so I spent like 3 years working out like crazy and learning like all about like basic nutritional stuff, which I knew nothing about. And so my life has changed because I got way less lumpy. I probably lost 30 pounds and I look a lot different. So that changed a lot. I think another thing that's changed, I'm just like way more of a homebody. So like I don't really leave my house a significant amount. I have what I need and I'm very happy and I know what makes me happy. And I just do that over and over and over again. You know, your buddies have a website called Routines, routines.fy. I forget what the URL is.
Routines.club.
.club. And they talk about like routines. I just do the same stuff mostly every single day. I eat the same thing. I do mostly the same exercise. I read similar type of stuff every night. Like I basically do the same thing over and over again. And in the last 3 years, I basically just honed in on what I like and I just do only that.
I think you said, and if this is too private, we can cut it, but I think at some point you told me you used to get depressed or kind of anxious and you were on an SSRI or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's helped you get through that? Because it doesn't seem like you're there anymore.
Yeah, so I don't take them anymore, but I took them for 10 years. I still take some, I forget what I take, lorazepam when I fly, because I still have claustrophobia issues. So like I hate elevators. I try to go upstairs. I don't take subways. So I freak out over like claustrophobia stuff, but I don't take the medicine anymore. One, I eat better. So like I learned like what to eat, what not to eat. Two, I exercise way more. So I'm basically like a dog that's like worn out at the end of the day. And three, I think having like a really strong emotionally like stable woman to like support me made it so I don't really need that anymore.
Totally. That makes a huge difference. Okay. So you've met all these... It's insane. And it's like, if everything is good on the home front, I feel like my anxiety is like 50%. So you mentioned you've met all these interesting people. You've got lots of great friends and stuff. You're in forums with all these different people. Is there anyone you've met or learned about that you're confident is happy and would be your North Star? So for example, when you imagine Sam, when you're 75, who do you want to be like? Like, what direction are you pointed? And is there a person that you're modeling?
So I've got this friend. Well, I won't talk about this too much. I model a lot of what I do. I think about how you react to certain stuff. So, I mean, you're definitely an inspiration, but I'm not going to make this the Andrew circle trick episode.
No, that's good. Let's talk about that for 10 minutes.
No, I definitely get inspired all the time by it. But what you do, I read Tiny's quarterly reports all the time. And I'm like, oh, that's so fascinating. He's doing this and that. And so, you know, you're an inspiration to me. One of my best friends is this guy named Jack Smith. So Jack Smith he's a British immigrant. He lived in America. He started a company when he was 22 and it was called Vungle. And he sold Vungle for $850 million when he was 28. And he made a lot of money. And he still dresses like a bum. And he's the only guy who I've ever met who made a nice amount of money through he's self-made and was like, this is enough. I don't need any more. And so he spends all of his time writing prisoners. So his thing that he loves is making sure when you get out of prison that you've got a skill set or something so you don't go back to prison. And he spends most of his days writing prisoners, and he has got a charity where he buys them any type of like book that they want, as long as like a lot of math books, things like that. He also is very logical, where he doesn't like get caught up in certain, like he almost like Charlie Munger, where they're like borderline autistic, where they like don't experience certain human emotions in a good way, but they like, he'll like buy the best gifts. And I think he buys the best gifts for me because he read in a book, when you care about someone, you should be really thoughtful about which gifts. And so he'll buy like a gift. He's like, hey, I remember last year you said that you really were interested in X, Y, and Z. So I found the best version of that and I got it for you. And so Jack Smith is one of my heroes. Another guy we had in the pod, there's two guys. One is Laird Hamilton. So Laird Hamilton is the surfer who got famous for just being a surfer. And then he went on to start a variety of companies, including Laird Superfoods, I think it's called, where it's like a creamer. Yeah. So he's amazing. And so he's someone who I'm like, that guy has carved a path and he lives the best, like most ideal life. So he basically works out with all these cool people in his pool and they all come to him, and he's got a beautiful wife who seems supportive and wonderful and his kids love him. So that's awesome. And then the third person is Rob Dyrdek. So Rob came on our pod. When we originally booked him, I was like, what the fuck does this skateboarder know about business? I don't want to talk to this dork. And we talked to him and he blew me away. He was the most impressive person I've ever talked to. He does these crazy things where he tracks his time, and he's so dialed into how he tracks his time. And I'm not into that. I don't like tracking my time like that, but he did. And I was inspired by it. And he knew like, this is how much time I have per day. So I'm going to spend this many minutes doing this, this many minutes doing that. He's probably worth $350 million. He's got a lovely family. And he like has carved his path where he's like, I'm going to build this house. I'm going to call it Dyrdek Estates. Or Forever Estates, and I'm going to own this home for 300 years so my family can do this forever and ever and ever. And he like makes these bold declarations, and he like buys a plot of land for $12 million when he only has $13 million. And he's like, I'm going to figure out the rest and we're going to make it happen. And I love people that call their shot, and he does.
So I want to switch gears a little bit to tactics. So what, you know, what do you do to be productive? What kind of stuff, you know, like I was saying to you before we started recording, like I want this podcast to be something where people get off and they can buy like 5 books. They can go on Amazon and buy a bunch of products. They can go and learn about some new productivity system or whatever it is. How does the sausage get made? And so I want to ask you a little bit about like your day-to-day routines and stuff. First of all,
I've got a big list.
I see it prepared. What's like a typical day for you look like? And what are those like key habits for you?
My typical day is like super boring. So I get up at between 7 and 7:30. I don't have an alarm. Right now I wake up when the baby or when my wife wakes up, but typically at 7 or 7:30. I lift weights 5 days a week typically. And on a day that I'm not lifting weights, I like to cold plunge in the morning. On days that I do lift weights, I go for a 1 hour walk. I play with the baby until 9 a.m. And then I like to drink coffee. I drink decaf coffee. I use Commentier. And this is not a plug, but I use my AeroPress. So I use decaf coffee with Commentier or my AeroPress. I actually have 2 AeroPresses because I thought I lost one and I bought 2 of them. So if it's a podcast day, which is 2 to 3 days a week, I do prep from 9 to 11 a.m. I record for about 1.5 hours. I eat lunch at noon. I typically eat a meat and a carb, so like a chicken and a sweet potato. Then I'll work more from like 1 to 5. So I say I've got a 9 to 5 because I usually work from 9 to 5, but I'm taking breaks every 30 or 40 or 50 minutes to see my wife or baby. I go to the gym at 5 p.m. typically. and that takes about an hour and 30 minutes. And then I do Legos as we eat dinner and hang out with the baby. And then I like to do Legos from like 9 to 10, just me and my wife with the TV off. And then I go lay in bed at about 10 and I'll read from 10 to 11.
You know, it's so interesting that you guys are doing Legos. Me and my girlfriend, she was getting a bit annoyed because I'll talk all day. Like I talk for a living, right? I'm on Zoom calls or I'm context switching and emailing or doing meetings.
And you don't want to talk at the end of the day.
I don't want to talk. So I get home and I'm like, basically like, look, like I need to go into a catatonic state and just relax for 2 hours and then we can talk later. And she kind of felt like that was a bit harsh and I'm kind of like pushing her away or whatever. And I realized it's not that I need to not be around her. It's that I need to actually just like focus on something. And so we started playing chess, which I assume serves the same purpose as the Lego because we silently sit there and yet we both perceive it to be quality time together. That's I got to try Lego. That's really smart.
My quality time is just sitting with my wife or kid, not talking. And I'll just put my hand on her shoulder or on her back. I'm like, I just want to sit next to you. You can talk if you want. I'm not going to say a word. I just want to be next to you.
It's awesome. And then, okay, one thing that astounds me about you is your ability to talk. I remember, so like last February, I guess it was, we hosted an event in Vancouver where we did a live MFM. And usually when I go on MFM, you know, you and Sean, you guys have like such great chemistry and, you know, you're such naturals and stuff. But usually when I come on, I'm actually prepped. So I, like I said, I've got like a big doc in front of me. And so I'm just rattling off a whole bunch of bullet points and things I want to talk about or whatever. But we go on stage and we're in front of like, I don't know, 2,000 nerds or 2,000 something crazy.
People, yeah.
And it was really, we're all kind of nervous and stuff. And you guys went out there and I was shocked. You guys were like professional comedians and you were so good at filling, you were great at anecdotes, but you're so good at filling silence, right? You guys can just talk and talk and talk. And part of being able to talk and talk and talk is having a shitload of really interesting stuff to talk about. And I know that your way of having that is by learning and reading. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how you absorb interesting things to share with others. So how do you read? How do you learn? How do you structure it so you remember that?
I've got a very detailed way of doing that. And I want to say Sean's actually way better than that than I am. And we're good at that live because we've done 600 episodes with each other. And so we know how to do it.
I mean, dude, we were at Camp MFM and it's like there's probably 20 guys all in a circle. And Sean told this story about going to a prison and getting called out by one of the inmates for being fake or something. And it was one of the most amazing stories I'd ever heard. And he, like, everyone's just like leaning in on every word. You guys are getting so good at storytelling.
He's very good at it. And what we're good at together is knowing when to shut up and when not to shut up. And we call it the bro move. So we always set each other up. So like, you know, when someone's like, dude, I bought this thing. It was so expensive. Guess how much it was. And so like, you always guess under, you never guess over. And so like, there's like little things that we know how to do to set each other up. You know, it's like, so then what happened? You know what I mean? All right. So how do I learn? So I read about a book a week. I don't read to read a book a week. I read to fulfill my entertainment. I don't read to grow. I don't read to learn. It's just entertainment. I'm pretty specific about how I read. I only read on Kindle. I don't do audiobooks usually. And it has to be a Kindle Oasis. The reason why the Kindle Oasis is the best Kindle is because it has a glass screen and I find that easier to read. And it also has a handle on the side so I can lay in bed on the side and read. So I read a Kindle Oasis. So I'm like pretty adamant about that. I underline or highlight in the Kindle all the time. And as I'm reading, the next morning, I'll go on Wikipedia and I'll read about what I'm reading about. So I have more context and I'll review my notes. And I'll think that's like, you know, what
is Readwise or something to surface those?
I use Goodreads. So I spend a crazy amount of time research what I'm going to read. And I use Goodreads to find the book. And then I just use the Kindle app to review my notes and I'll be like, oh, I'm going to bring this up story up on the pod and I'll just like review, or I'm going to talk about this on Twitter, or that's just fascinating. Wow. There was only 200 Secret Service agents in 1980. That's insane to me. Isn't that wild? You know, like I'll just like shocking bits. I'll highlight them. I only read for about 60 minutes a day, which seems, I guess, like a lot, but it doesn't feel like a lot because if I'm not interested in something, I end the book and I go to something new. But usually a 350 page book is about 7 hours of reading. And so I go through one a week, like pretty easily, or sometimes even more. Sometimes I'll read a book in 2 days or 3 days if I really dig it, or if it's a weekend, I'll sit and read the whole thing. And so I do it for entertainment. I think that a lot of people will read stuff that's supposed to make them grow, like self-helpy stuff. And I don't do that. I really don't do any of that. I only read what's interesting. And for me, it's mostly history. But lately, some novels have been interesting to me. If I don't like a book after 10% of reading the book, I put it down. I end it. And I track everything on Goodreads. And I purposely don't share my Goodreads because they're going to be like, dude, there's a lot of Hitler stuff on here. What's going on? Or like, why are you reading about the KKK so much?
So we do our annual general meeting. So we're a public company, right? And we do our annual general meeting. And in the AGM, somebody said, they made a comment about, you know, how, do you spend time learning about history and financial history and stuff? And I say, oh, funny you mentioned that. I'm actually reading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich right now about how, you know, it's amazing. Amazing book about World War II and Hitler and how he came to power. And from my perspective, I look at it and just go, wow, like bad things can happen in normal places, right? And so I talk about that. And then later in the, I think it was like 30 minutes later, somebody said, how are you different than private equity? And so I say, it's a little bit like if I said, I'm Catholic, when I let's say I'm dating a bunch of girls and I say, I'm Catholic and it's really important that we have a Catholic wedding, a Catholic ceremony. And right when I get to the altar, the girl goes, oh, actually I'm Jewish. And I go, oh, what the heck? Like, why didn't you just tell me in the beginning? Now we can't get married. And it was so funny because I think people heard Hitler, you know, from like the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And then they heard, oh, he doesn't want to marry a Jewish girl. And it was like these things go together in people's minds. And I was like, oh my God, this is so, dude, it's so funny.
Dude, I had this incident where I was reading this book, Blitz, and it's about how the Nazis love drugs. And I was like, they did this really interesting leadership technique that was actually really effective. And it was like this, this, and this. And my editor on the podcast put leadership lessons you could learn from Hitler. And I was like, dude, what? No, that's I did kind of say it that way, but you totally understand that's not the point. That was not at all what I was trying to get at.
When you look like us with blonde hair and it just doesn't work. You can't do it.
It does not work. And so I was like, you guys, that's not at all. That's not how we should do this stuff. But anyway, I read a lot. Yeah, I read a ton and I am on a Hitler kick just like every other 30 something year old.
You said something funny on here. You said, I don't think the best way to learn is by reading a lot of books. It's by reading the same books over and over again. Like what would those books be for you? Do you have a sense of some of those like critical foundational books that you can go back to over and over again?
Yeah. So Carnegie by David Nassau. So the biography of Andrew Carnegie. I got married at Carnegie Hall because of my love for Andrew Carnegie. I'm like a huge fan of Andrew Carnegie. I think he did a lot of bad things, but he was mostly amazing. So I love his book. I reread Mastery by Robert Greene. Mastery changed my life because it was the idea of like, before I was like, generalists are awesome. And then I was like, read this book and it was like, no, dude, you need a skill set. To have a skill set is actually the best thing. And then you could go more general, but to have a skill set is like life changing. And so Mastery changed my life. And then the biography of John Rockefeller, it's called Titan. He's a really fascinating person because he was basically, imagine the equivalent of like Bezos and Elon combined. That's how wealthy this guy was. But he was such an honest, good human being. He was a good family man. He was loyal to his wife. He was a great father. He didn't lie. He lied one time ever on public record. Besides that, he was like a really, really amazing person who had really good confidence and made good decisions. So I reread Titan all the time.
It's interesting you mentioned Robert Greene because I think I'd give that same answer. I would say if you read 48 Laws of Power, Mastery, and The Laws of Human Nature, you could read those three books over and over and over again and you'd learn like probably 95% of what you need to know about like business and psychology. Those
and
are
it's
some
like
of the
keys to life. Like yeah. You read his stuff and you're like, if I just read those three books, I know everything there is to know about people.
So what's something you did recently that made you go, I can't believe I didn't do this sooner? What are some like interesting, either new habits or products or tactics or whatever?
I'll tell you a few. The first, I use a service called My Body Tutor. I have zero affiliation with them, but I'll promote them anyway. It's a service that I spend, I think, $300 a month, and I talk to them weekly, sometimes daily via text or calls, and they monitor my diet by just me telling them and looking at my Fitness Pal, and they, like, you know, will set goals. Like, I want to get skinnier. I want to gain weight. I just want to stay the same. So I use My Body Tutor. I have a fitness coach. It's kind of, I think it's $350 a month. and they make all of my workouts for me. Every quarter, we pick a different athletic goal. And they helped me get there. A few other things, a Creamy. So the Creamy is the greatest appliance in the last 20 years. It's changed my life. And it's changed my life because over the last 3 years, I started making it very intentional to eat the proper amount of protein. I think most Americans don't eat nearly enough protein. Protein's an amazing thing to eat because it makes you full and it gives you what you need to maintain or build muscle, which is essential to living a long, healthy life. And a Creamy is the best way to consume protein, in my opinion. It's the best. So it's basically a cup of milk, a cup of almond milk, 2 scoops of protein. You freeze it overnight and you can spin it on this machine, a Creamy, and it turns it into ice cream. And I don't like eating a lot of meat because it just doesn't taste great to me. And this is like the easiest way for me to consume protein. So I love a Creamy. Another thing is Fitiv. So I use Fitiv. It's an app that tracks my heart rate. So I don't use watches because I don't want another device that I have to charge. So I use a Garmin heart strap and I use Fitiv. Fitiv is an app that connects to my heart rate monitor. And for every workout, I have a heart rate zone that I'm trying to stay inside of because sometimes people tend to go too hard or too easy. And I use this where I don't look at my phone, but I have my headphones in and it tells me if I'm in the zone or not in the zone to go easy, to go hard, whatever. So I use that like crazy. I think those are some of the things that I like.
I texted you. I just bought one of those Creamies and I'm very skeptical. It feels like the Instant Pot of 2024. No. But no, okay, this is like a revolution. How long have you been doing this for, though?
So for the last 4 years, I would have one protein shake a day. It was the same thing. It was 2 scoops of chocolate protein, 1 scoop of frozen cherries, and 1 cup of almond milk. That was I would have that almost every single day. And I got sick of it. And I always crave sugar. Sugar is like my drug now. And I was like, I don't want to eat this ice cream, but I want to so badly. And I found this Creamy like 2 months ago and I'll eat one of them a day. And so one pint of Creamy is like 300 grams of or 300 calories and it's 65 grams of protein.
Okay, I'm gonna try this out tonight. I've got it all set up and I'm ready to go.
You have to figure it out though. So there is art to it to figure out which recipes you like. But the Creamy is the greatest thing I've used. And then I'll give one last product, Opal. OPAL. It's an app that blocks all of social media from my phone, and I have no idea how to uninstall it. And so it's really effective.
That's awesome. We'll link all these in the show notes. Also, one final question. So, who's someone fascinating that not many people know about that they should look up?
All right. I've got a few of them. I've got three of them. The first, there's this new podcast. I never listen to business podcasts. I don't read business books. I don't even listen to business podcasts. It's called Business Untitled. And the host is this guy named Mike Norwinski, I think. You would know him. He was either one of the founders of Fortress Capital or he was high up. And then he went and started, I think it's called, what's the big crypto digital company? Like DGI?
You know, Galaxy Digital?
Yeah. He started that. And then his co-host is another. So Mike's a billionaire. Mike's worth probably.
Oh, Mike Novogratz. Yeah.
Novogratz.
I've met him before. I had dinner with him.
He seems like a badass. I don't know him, but he seems like a badass. And then his co-host is this guy named David, who's a real estate billionaire. And they have this podcast that's similar to All In, of them just shooting the shit. I think it's way better than All In. I think All In's great, but I think Business Untitled is really fascinating. If you go to their YouTube page, dude, they've got 3,000 subscribers. It's not popular at all, but this podcast is actually really good. Another person. It's great. No one talks about this podcast, but it's really good. All right. Here's another good thing. Do you follow Baller Busters on Instagram?
No, I don't use Instagram because I don't use Opal. I use Freedom and I'm blocked. I'm totally blocked.
So I can only go on before 9 a.m. and after 8 p.m. And so I'll see it every once in a while. But there's this Instagram handle called Baller Busters and they like do investigation on get rich quick gurus. And it's so funny to like get caught up in this like YouTube thing where I see all these successful people. I'm like, oh, they're crushing it. And these guys just like do like super deep investigative research and be like, no, this guy's lying to you. Or here's like proof that it's a scam. I like that. Another person. And here's the last one. The last person that I'm interested in. Have you ever heard of Penske Media Corporation?
No.
So PMC. All right. So there's this guy named Jay Penske. So you're in Canada, so I don't know if you know this, but there's these trucks. There's this moving company called Penske Moving. And
yeah, I see that everywhere here.
Okay, so Penske, let's see, what was the guy's name who started it? Roger. So Roger Penske, he originally was, I think, a race car driver. which is weird. And then he like parlayed that into starting an auto parts store. And then he parlayed that into starting a moving company or like truck rental. He became a billionaire that way. He has this kid named Jay. He's not a kid anymore. He's in his 50s. Who's like this super good looking guy. And I wanted to hate him so bad because like, oh, this billionaire kid, he's on Martha's Vineyard. He seems like a sweetheart guy. Like now that I've gotten to know him, he seems like a great guy. Well, he started this company called Penske Media. No one ever talks about it, but I'm going to tell you some of the things that they own. They own Variety Magazine, Rolling Stone, Women's Wear Daily, Deadline Hollywood, The Rob Report, The Hollywood Reporter. They own Dick Clark Productions, which puts on the Golden Globe Awards, the American Music Awards, Billboard Music Awards. It's this company that's doing hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. It's profitable. They own, I think at this point, like 30% of Vox Media. This guy is really fascinating. He does very little media. He seems like a great guy. He owns, I think, 60 or 70% of that company that does many, many, many hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. So it's worth billions of dollars. And I want to get him on the pod, but I've been reading about this guy. He's so fascinating. People don't talk about him, but I think he's actually one of the best digital media operators out there because he's killing it when a lot of people aren't. And he's quiet about it.
He sounds awesome. I'd love to meet him, actually.
Google him.
Did you meet him yet? Or you're just kind of like,
no, I don't know him. I don't know him. Okay. I've just read about him. Just Google him. You want to hate him because he's got slick back hair. He's very good looking and he looks like a rich guy. But so I immediately I'm going to hate this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I read interviews with him and I've talked to a couple people that worked with him and I'm like, this guy seems just like a doll. He seems like such a nice human being. He seems like he has a great balance of being the right amount of cutthroat, but having the right amount of empathy. And I've read about this guy and he's so fascinating. And so Jay Penske is someone who I think is a little bit unknown, but he's a huge baller and I want to get to know him.
Awesome. Well, dude, thanks so much for coming on. This was really fun. It's always always nice chat. I appreciate you doing the first episode because we're just winging it here. So,
well, hopefully you guys chop it up and you come up with something good. But thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks, dude.